Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello, Dad. Welcome back.
Well, hello, Tater. Glad to be here on this chilly, chilly November day.
Man, it's kind of cold. Well, what's your temp like down there?
Hell, this morning when I woke up, it was 27 degrees outside.
27?
Yeah. I couldn't believe it.
It was 45 today, and I thought it was cold.
It warmed up to 52 later in the afternoon, but it was cold getting there. It's still going to be down in the 20s again tonight. It doesn't moderate any until about Saturday or Sunday. We might have snow tomorrow night.
Oh, man. This is early in November for that. I mean, I guess that's good, but...
No. It is turning the leaves, though. The leaves were still green up until this week.
Yeah, we've had a bit more of a natural fall up here, but I'm supposed to do some outdoor activities on Saturday, and I don't want it to be cold.
I don't blame you. Well, one thing that's good, whether it's hot or cold, is beer.
Hey, beer, that's true.
Yeah, beer is always your companion. Wherever you go, it's your best friend.
This is true. This topic is sort of apropos of nothing, but I saw that Bud Seltzer has released its newest pack of weird holiday-themed seltzer waters. There's like eggnog and... I don't know what, like gingerbread, probably. They sound terrible.
But inquiring minds want to know.
Yes. But it's a far cry from, like, I think a lot of the image that even I grew up with Budweiser is just like, it's a beer. That's it. They do this one beer, then there's a light version of it, but that's it for Bud. So, you know, they're branching off, doing new things, keeping up the times. That's cool. But I thought it might be cool to delve into the history of Budweiser. You know, it's the king of beers. It's this international sort of juggernaut of beer sales. Where did it come from? How did it get to be what it is today?
I think it's quite interesting to learn the background details on an American iconic business such as it is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's nowadays it's considered as American as, say, apple pie, which, incidentally, isn't all that American, actually. And would you be surprised to know that neither is Budweiser?
Yeah. And Chevrolet. And Chevrolet is a French word. So, you know, we're stealing all kinds of things. I don't know.
We got nothing. So the story, I mean, it is an American story and it also isn't. The story of Budweiser, it begins in Germany, really, on July 19th. 1839, because that's the day that Adolphus Busch is born in Kassel, Germany. He was the 21st of 22 children, but his family was nonetheless very wealthy. They were wholesalers of brewing and winemaking supplies, and he received an excellent education at the Collegiate Institute of Belgium in Brussels before setting sail with three of his brothers for America in 1857, where he would eventually settle in St. Louis, Missouri. In Missouri, Adolphus took a series of odd jobs. He served a brief stint in the Union Army, actually, during the American Civil War, before eventually going into business for himself in what his family knew best. He opened his own brewing supply company, and he sold to several dozen breweries around Missouri. One of his eventual customers would become of particular importance to his future. That was a Mr. Eberhard Anheuser. So if you know the full name of the company that makes Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch, now the pieces are hopefully coming together for you.
So, yep. That's where it came from, those two.
Now they're together, magic's going to happen. Anheuser originally worked in soap and candle manufacturing. He didn't know anything about brewing, but he was monetarily supporting this brewery called the Bavarian Brewery in town. And so when it eventually went under, he looked at it as an opportunity to get into the brewing business. He bought out the other partners, purchased the brewery, renamed it the Anheuser Brewery. And this, of course, led to the two-men meeting, originally just to provide Anheuser with brewing supplies. But as fate would have it, when Busch and Anheuser's daughter, Elise, met, sparks flew, and they were eventually married, uniting the two families.
Yeah, and he leaned on his new son-in-law to help him with his beer plant because, you know, the original owners had gone under because they didn't make very good beer. Nobody really liked it. So even though Anheuser had some money to pump it up, he still was making bad beer. So he still was not selling good. So he leaned on Adolphus to try to do something with the recipe and improve the flavor of the beer.
Yes, and Adolphus had comparatively richer knowledge of brewing. He studied the Pilsner process in Europe, but he also seeked out somebody pretty important to the story, Carl Conrad, who was a local restaurateur who also understood the brewing process. And Conrad actually was the one who devised the sort of name recipe combo. They decided to go with a beer that was lighter. It was a bohemian style lager. It definitely stood out from the beers at the time because most breweries were very small. They just supplied the surrounding area and they were generally making dark, heavy ales. This was sort of the American style beer up until this point. So when they come out with this very light, crisp, refreshing, drinkable Bavarian style lager, it's a completely different thing than what people were used to. And the recipe has basically stayed the same since this time period, since its original creation, obviously allowing for modernization. But it consists of only five ingredients. There is barley malt, there are hops, there's yeast. It is the same yeast that's been used since 1876, still used to this day. They like ship it around. It's protected. Water. Here's kind of the weird one, rice. The argued reason for this was that it makes the beer clean and crisp. Busch thought it would set his beer apart from other beers, you know, but also, which we're going to get a bit more into, he was a very shrewd businessman, and it might not surprise you to learn that using a portion of rice in your brew makes a cheaper beer.
Yeah, the rice was cheaper than the malted barley.
So, and now, of course, the name, this is, of course, they call their beer Budweiser, and this was, Conrad partially inspired this, because around, like, there was a beer already called Budweis that was being made in the Czech Republic, all the way back from, like 1265, like, this beer has been around, and it was often called the king of beers in its homeland. So I guess they're like, well, we're gonna, you know, there's not the internet yet. We can call our beer Budweiser and call it the king of beers and make it in this bohemian style, and it's fine. No one's going to know. Who's going to know?
They're going to know.
Yeah, eventually. There's like a pretty intense back and forth sort of trademark dispute that goes on up until very recently, between Budweiser, the American company, and Budweiser Budvar, the product that's in the Czech Republic, to figure out who can call what Budweiser. Like, for a while, Budweiser was Bud or Bud Light in Europe, certain parts of Europe. They couldn't use the full name. In any case, with the help of Carl Conrad and, of course, with Busch's sort of brilliant ability to guide the business, he became integral to it. They renamed it Anheuser-Busch in 1879, sort of in honor of all the work he was doing for the business. Not long after this, Eberhard Anheuser passes away, and Busch is left at the helm of the brewery. And he really makes his mark. He set out with a singular goal. He wants to make a beer that's not just serving the local community. He wants to make a nationally and hopefully even internationally famous beer. And to do that, he pursues the cutting-edge technology of the time. He's a real visionary of what a company can be in his time period. Like, for one thing, he's the first brewer to pasteurize his beer. To assure consistency. That's one thing he really wants to have. Everybody that's drinking his beer, he wants the same beer poured, whether you're in Texas or, you know, DC or Mexico. Like, it's going to have consistency. So he starts pasteurizing his beer. This was even before milk was regularly pasteurized. And along with this, to ensure this freshness, he builds a system of refrigerated rail cars to keep his beer well chilled for long transcontinental journeys. He's also an early adopter of the bottled beer and founds his own glass company, the Busch Glass Company, to make bottles for his own product. This sort of leans into really one of the big visionary elements of his business building, which is owning all parts of the production. If you want to use the term vertical integration, you can. But this was a huge part of his success. You know, instead of outsourcing to a bunch of other things, he decides just to buy his own bottling facility, his own ice manufacturers, his own coal mines, his own hop farms. He eventually gets in so he can make his own diesel engines to power his trucks that are going to supply people with his Budweiser. Like, it just really, like, cuts out all overhead because he just wants to own every element of production.
Yeah, and he also worked with the railroads to put in ice houses at the different stations because the refrigerator cars were not electric like a refrigerator. They were ice sitting in the walls that you dropped down in the walls and refrigerated the car with ice. So they had to have ice houses at the various stations for them to continue to ice the rail cars as they moved to their destination.
Oh, wow.
So he identified, you know, the biggest thing holding back getting a national brand was the spoilage. That's why everybody just distributed it locally in their area, because they couldn't keep the beer from spoiling before they could get it anywhere. So he solved both those problems with the pasteurization and the refrigeration.
And I mean, to great effect, this really became a Goliath in the beer industry at this time period. Like, there was a marked and documented drop in business of local breweries wherever Bud was available in town, because... Mm-hmm. You know, he could undersell most places and obviously, like, produce as much as needed. This was a first of its kind. However you feel about giant corporate breweries today, at the time period, it was really just, you know, groundbreaking.
Yeah, anything that brings more beer to the masses is welcomed.
Well, he also, you know, he was a master marketer, too. I mean, we're talking, you know, early 1900s. This is sort of when we're getting into really seeing the effects that ad campaigns can have. And, like, he had this German drinking style song recorded in 1903 by, like, a popular vaudeville star at the time, Billy Murray, that was became like a chart-topping hit. And it was about having, you know, some Budweiser and having pints with friends that made it onto the radio and, like, was well known. So kind of one of those early adopters of, like, how powerful ads can be. He was a man that gave back for, like, to both his homeland back in Germany and to his new home in America. He sent money to Mainz Castle, the region of Germany where he grew up, after they had devastating floods. He donated what today would be millions to San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake. He helped finance a Germanic museum at Harvard. So he did a lot of sort of philanthropy, if you want to offset how much he became a giant of industry. And I mean, clearly he meant something to the communities he impacted. After his death in 1913, tens of thousands showed up to pay their respects. Reported 25 trucks were needed to transport all the flowers sent to his family. A 20-mile-long funeral procession involving a 250-piece band marched in his honor. And throughout St. Louis, a 5-minute silence was observed. Hotels dimmed their lights. Streetcars halted in their tracks. And on his tomb, upon his request, Caesar's words, "Veni, vidi, vici," were inscribed. "I came, I saw, I conquered." Perhaps fitting for the man who brewed the beer that conquered the country. And it eventually impacted the entire world.
Yeah. That song that you mentioned was called "Under the Anheuser-Busch." And it was basically a love song, saying that's where lovers will meet and share a stein under the Anheuser-Busch.
Right.
It became a number one hit in 1903 as well. So it wasn't just, you know, kind of corny, but I found it and found a recording of it. So I'll add a piece of it at the end of this where you can hear how that song went.
Oh, nice. I love that. I mean, and after his passing, his children inherited the business, carried it on, and definitely continued on, I think, with his sort of shrewd business tactics in mind. Of course, you know, we're getting into the mid-1900s here. The same thing that comes up in any distillery or brewery story is going to come up here. Prohibition. What else?
Oh, yeah.
And Hauser-Busch was quick to get into the no alcohol or near beer market. They created like a cereal-based beverage, Bevo, to you know, sell something that was close to beer but was still legally allowed. They also started producing like corn syrups and soft drinks. One of the things that I think is pretty sneaky, but a lot of breweries did this, they just did it on a massive scale, is they would sell barley, rice, hops and yeast, perhaps conveniently together. So if you want to go home and do something with all that, you can, but we didn't sell you beer. We sold you barley, rice, hops and yeast.
Yeah, what you do with them is your own business.
We didn't sell you water, so we didn't sell you what you need to make beer, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Just a little snack pack, that's what it's for. You can make a little dinner tonight.
Yeah, I was amazed to learn they are the single biggest consumer of the American rice market.
Yeah.
Them and their associated beverages consume 30% of the American rice market.
That's wild.
Well, it's a lot of rice.
There was something else that they did for Prohibition to survive, which I think is funny.
Well, they made ice cream. I don't know. I don't know what the connection between beer and ice cream, but if you remember from our Yingling episode, Yingling did that too. As a matter of fact, they still make ice cream. But I don't know how a beer plant easily converts to an ice cream plant. That doesn't make sense to me, but it must have been something that works because there's two big ones that did that.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, through a variety of means, through diversifying their portfolio, they survived Prohibition. They operated the entire time at full force. And on repeal day, they introduced, which we'll get back to, still things that they use in ads to this day, but they introduced their Budweiser Clydesdale horses, like these big, beautiful horses, like driving these, you know, red and gold carts of Budweiser around to celebrate Prohibition's end. So they had money to spare, I guess, if you can shell out for your own horses.
Yeah. And those Clydesdales are very majestic beasts, and they meet demanding standards to be a Budweiser Clydesdale too. Not just any Clydesdale makes it. They have to be all be geldings 4 years old or older, 72 inches tall at least, and weigh between 1,800 and 2,300 pounds. Then they also have to sport a bay coat with white blaze and legs, while their mane and tail must be black.
This is a very high qualification for being a Budweiser Clydesdale.
Yeah, and even with those restrictions, they've built up a herd of 250 of them.
Well, and, you know, the to kind of get into how they... Because, I mean, the beer's been the same the whole way, and it's really, obviously, they introduced Bud Light, and in more recent years, they've introduced some other products we'll get into. But one of the big driving forces for Budweiser this whole time has been the ad campaigns. You know, you mentioned the horses, but there are a couple other animal mascots that they use throughout the ages. There's one that I read about a bit. Apparently, you know on a first-name basis, and that's Spuds McKenzie. It's a dog,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he was, I don't know what kind of dog he was, because I don't know dogs that well, but he was white, and he had, you know, the black spots on him. He had, like, the one eye was like a black circle and everything, and he was a cool dog. He wore sunglasses, and he was at all the college frat parties, and all the girls loved Spuds McKenzie. They'd all go up to him, you know, and want to share a beer with Spuds, because he was the big man on campus.
That was the time period for that was apparently 87 to 89, and that feels very 80s and 80s alone.
Yeah.
Cool dog in sunglasses. And then we had the frogs following that in the 90s. You had the Budweiser and the What's Up Frogs.
And they did that. They first started out, they were croaking on the log, and they had them lined up, and one would go, Bud. And the other would go, why? And the other would go, zur. And then they'd just start croaking faster and faster. Budweiser, Budweiser.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were also one of the first big brands to really invest in the Super Bowl, too. You know, get that, like, when we now where we have these, you know, million-dollar ad spots for the Super Bowl, like, Budweiser was one of the first to, like, really capitalize on that, like, recognizing that you can, mm-hmm. like, both sponsoring the game and also, like, being a major ad component of it.
Yeah, yeah, that was one of their biggest things, and their ads were always greatly anticipated every year at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, yeah. Well, apparently they also had in 2010 they had their own online reality TV series called Bud House, which it was specifically related to the 2010 FIFA World Cup in South Africa, but it followed the lives of 32 international football fans living together in a house in South Africa. So, you know, you want to get into the reality TV trend of the early 2000s.
I didn't know about that. Now, I did see that they had their own pinball machine out, or video game, maybe it was.
The video game, Tapper.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Video game that they had out. And then, but eventually they pulled their backing on that and it became Root Beer Tapper. Because Budweiser wouldn't let them use their stuff.
Yeah, apparently you can still find some old ones that are still properly branded. But yeah, to sort of bring it into modern times, of course, as we mentioned, they've, you know, brewed their straight up Budweiser for since the beginning, but then introduced, you know, Bud Light. There's Bud Ice, Bud Light Lime, which was, you know, the slightly lime flavored one. They've got their like Bud Light sort of micheladas and margarita inspirations, but right now in the market they've got their this was just 2020, they introduced their Bud Light seltzers in a variety of flavors. Now they have their seasonal flavors, and interestingly enough, they also last year introduced a Bud Zero, which is the first alcohol-free low-calorie beer on the American market at such a large scale. Which...
Yeah, it said that Budweiser, I think its biggest year was 1988, and it produced a record 50 million barrels of Bud. And it took until, it was the number one beer in America until 2001, when its little brother Bud Light bumped it out and moved it to second. And then Coors Light, which they own Coors. Coors Light bumped them out a few years later, bumped them out of second place to third, and they're currently in third place. So you got Bud Light was number one, then Coors Light, then Bud.
Wow. How far down on that list do you have to go to get a beer that's not owned by Budweiser or Anheuser-Busch?
Yeah, you have to go away. Yeah, there were a lot of different brands, like Michelob. You had Michelob and Michelob Light and Michelob Ultra. You know, that's all Budweiser. There's some other ones. I forget. There was another one that was real fancy that I thought, boy, that's a good beer. Then I get to read the label and say, oh, that's Anheuser-Busch, too. That's another Budweiser beer. Yeah. They had a lot of different brands at one time they were putting out. And then they've started buying out a bunch of different brands and put them all under the name Anheuser-Busch InBev.
Well, you know, sort of a weird wrap-up on all this is that I guess technically now... Budweiser is not an American beer.
Yeah, that's true. Cause
it is. It's brewed. I mean, they're giant like production companies in America, but it was acquired in 2008 by InBev, which is actually a company based in Belgium. So it is not necessarily an American beer anymore.
It's gone back to its Bavarian roots.
I guess so.
Yeah, because Yingling is the largest American beer, I think.
Is it?
Yeah, because Miller is owned by a foreign company as well.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a German success story that continues to be a German success story.
It just took a while to wind its way back to Germany.
There you go.
You know, one of the things that I always wondered about, because I never really knew what it was, but it says on all the cans or bottles that it's beechwood aged.
Ah, yes.
And you don't taste beechwood in it. So it's like, what does that mean exactly? And it's really the beechwood is part of their production process. The beer is aged in tanks, and they spiral strips of beechwood in there, but it isn't meant to add woody flavors or anything. It's just a technique that's used to put more of the yeast in contact with the beer. The chips of beechwood used for the process have been treated and sterilized, so they don't impart any flavors on their own. But introducing a substrate like beechwood into the aging process can help remove undesirable flavors from the finished beer.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I've noticed that too, and it's just, it's a part of the process, but not like, oh, beechwood, we've got some woody flavor in this.
Yeah, or you would think that they store it in beechwood kegs or something like that to age or something, but that's not the case. They're using steel tanks, but they have spirals of beechwood in them for that purpose.
I mean, you know, I think if you look back on like the full story of Bud and going back to its founders, Bush had one goal, and he achieved it, and I mean, really mm-hmm. changed how, I don't know, I mean, it's weird to look at it from this angle, from where it was so innovative in so many ways, like, changed how beer was made, how beer was preserved, how it was sold, and for so long, I think my perspective has been that we, craft breweries have tried to fight back against these giant corporations that are producing all the beer in the country. And it's only now really that we've had a return to like readily available local beer, which was the opposite, you know, response to all this. But I mean, for what he set out to do, there was a lot of, you know, really innovative techniques introduced. It is at the end of the day, however you feel about Budweiser flavor wise, it has been the same thing for, you know, over 100 years. It's been the same beer produced in a very simple 5-ingredient way, which I think I have a certain amount of respect for. There's a certain amount of integrity there. So, you know.
Well, I mean, it's just like going to eat at McDonald's. You don't go there expecting a gourmet meal. You go there expecting what it is, and it's probably the biggest single restaurant in the world.
I am a little bit more dubious about the ingredients in McDonald's food than the ingredients in Budweiser beer. I will say that.
Well, that's true. I wasn't talking about the ingredients as much as I was just the frequency of visits.
Yeah, you know, it definitely created an entire style, like Budweiser, that style of beer, which was really even almost controversial when it was introduced. You know, you had a giant influx of German people around the time that Adolphus immigrated, and they brought with them that palate that understood, like, light lagers and Pilsner-style beers. But, like, when you were just dealing with the Americans, like, there are stories of, you know, Americans spitting Budweiser back in the bartender's face because they were so offended at how light and effervescent and non-beer-like it tasted. So it definitely drove a giant palate change in the American marketplace that really only continued from there because, you know, and then you get to, like World War One and World War Two, when you had a lot of women drinking beer and, like, entering, like, the drinking marketplace and really enjoying the kind of crisper, cleaner, lighter beers and having beer made to appeal to that palate. So I think you can weigh the pros and cons of what a giant corporation like Budweiser has done, but I wouldn't call it all bad.
Well, I mean, you set out to be the first national brew and you end up being the biggest seller in the country. You know, I would say he accomplished everything he set out to do. And, you know, they were very innovative and, you know, the refrigerated rail cars ended up being used in a lot of other stuff that helped America grow, you know, besides just beer. That became something that was used in a lot of other things that you were able to make national and ship further because of that. So, you know, it had a lot of benefits of what they did. And they were very reactive to their customers too. Had the story of one salesman who reported back to him, said that like a 6-pack of 12-ounce cans there cost more in the area where he was at than like other beers. And he said he needed to do something about it to be more competitive, to be able to sell more beer. And I said, what do you think? He said, well, look, if you could make 10-ounce cans instead of 12-ounce cans, I could sell them for the same price as the other ones, and you just, you know, but they'd have more beer in it. And sure enough, it worked. They started producing 10-ounce cans and six packs to sell in this region, and they started selling all kinds of them then. They were beating out all the other brands, and a lot of the people swore that the beer in the smaller cans tasted better than the ones in the 12-ounce cans.
Huh. That was, but they weren't deceiving people. They knew that there was less beer there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were labeled as 10-ounce. They were definitely smaller cans, and they were labeled as 10-ounce, but they would sell them for the same price then instead of having to sell the 12-ounce cans for more, and people were willing to pay that same price and get the 10-ounce cans.
I don't know. You know, there's some. I don't know if I like that, but you got to respect the hustle.
Well, you know, it's like there's a lot of beers that I get now, craft beers, and they come in four packs instead of six packs.
Yeah.
And it's still $10 or $12 for a four pack, you know.
Right.
So if they made a six pack, I might not buy a $20 six pack, you know, but I might buy a $10 four pack. So, you know, I think I can see some reasoning behind that.
Well, but Budweiser has done what it's had to do to survive the test of time, continue to be like you mentioned, its heyday is a little bit, I wouldn't say its heyday is past. It's still a giant in the industry, but it's not the top selling beer anymore. And I think it's definitely got a lot of competition in such a craft marketplace. But even so, for as many like fancy craft bars and restaurants as I've worked at, it's consistently on the menu that it's just assumed you're going to have Bud in some form, like at a lot of places, you know, having like a bottle or a can of Bud as like a cheap option to your craft beer menu is pretty normal.
Well, I would say as the boomers die out, the demand for a lot of Budweiser is going to die out with them. That those are the ones still hanging on.
Well, that's why they're getting into the seltzer marketplace, right? Like, how do we get into this? Which I don't know.
Diversify. Yeah.
I've had some of their like the when they just did like the, you know, like raspberry or whatever seltzers. They taste like the other seltzers are fine. I don't think they're better or worse. But some of these seasonal offerings that they've gotten into, I don't know. I'm not sure I feel about that.
Well, I've said it before. I always heard growing up people say, you don't really know what beer tastes like because the beer in America is nothing like what real beer is like. And it wasn't until this craft beer movement that I had any concept of what they could have been talking about.
Yeah, well, it's funny because as we mentioned, that the Budweiser style is based on a style that is German in origin. So, you know, it is a style that you encounter. It's pretty popular, like super crisp, bright lagers and pilsners. Like that's a whole category in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if Budweiser quite holds up. Maybe it's that rice, who knows? But
well, yeah, that's what I was wondering. I wonder if that Bavarian recipe that they were kind of emulating, if it had rice in it, or if that was something they did out of the shrewdness of saving money.
I don't know, but now it's part of the character. And I mean, that being said, I've had other beers brewed with rice that I really enjoy. So I don't think that's necessarily a downfall of any beer. But
mm-hmm.
Well, if it works, it works, and it worked for Bud. So
sure,
I guess
Bud's for you.
You know, sometimes we talk about things on the show that we go and make fun weird cocktails with. I'm not even gonna pretend to know how to make a interesting Budweiser cocktail. I don't think that's a thing. I think it can make a perfectly serviceable, if you want to do like a beer mimosa, like if you want just a beer to cut with some orange juice and you want it to not cost you too much for brunch, that's fine. You know, if you want a beer that you can buy a 40 ounce of and it's not going to be malt liquor, it's at least going to be beer, I think that's a fine place for Bud. And, you know, and if you want to sit at a dive bar and drink a beer and a shot, I think that's a fine place for Bud. I think putting it in a cocktail is silly.
Or as they said, one place where we were doing some day drinking when we were on that whiskey tour, that bourbon tour, they said a shot and a lawnmower beer.
Lawnmower beer, yeah. Yeah.
That qualifies. That's a lawnmower beer.
Yeah, it's just it almost doesn't count as a beer. I feel like it's just it takes up space. It makes the time pass.
It's better than nothing, damn it.
When I like, it's the perfect answer for me. When I, you know, if somebody invites me like a party or something, and I'm not really in a party mood, but I want to go there and like stay for a certain amount of time. I also don't want to spend money. Like I'm not gonna, you know, buy an expensive like low ABV cocktail or a mocktail. I'm just gonna get a Bud or two because, you know, I'm gonna spend maybe $10. I know what I'm getting. It's fine.
Yeah, that's true. I tell you the truth, I haven't had a Bud in so long or a Miller because I always am drinking whatever's on draft and, you know, of the craft beer. So
You're a fancy boy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to go back once you've been there.
I like Budweiser specifically when I'm building furniture. Like if I've got like
the beer to build furniture by.
Right? Like if you've got some like shitty IKEA furniture you've got to put together and you know it's just going to be a little frustrating. Like I don't that's like I'm going to drink a Budweiser and build this Cloyinge to Fauner, whatever. I don't know. IKEA furniture name. That's what it's good for.
Well, it's still an immigrant success story in America.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, however the company has progressed, I think you look back at the life of the original dude, he seemed okay. He did some good stuff.
Yeah. He was a genius, if you ask me. Kids. He had 13 kids. Well, he was one of 22, so, you know.
Yeah, that was modest, I guess, for his family.
Yeah, that was barely over half.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, over on the video, we will not be making Budweiser cocktails. I think that's silly. Maybe we'll be drinking some Bud to wash down the taste of if I can get my hands on them. Dad, I know this is maybe one of the few things that you can get in West Virginia and I can't get in New York. And that's the Budweiser, Bud Light Seltzer Seasonal 4-Pack. They just came out with their Christmas offerings. It looks unholy. I'm scared. But if I can find it, we're going to do a little taste test. What does eggnog seltzer taste like? I don't want to know, but we're going to know, hopefully.
Yeah, I'll get my college girl hook up there to bring me home something like that so that I don't want to walk in and buy something like that, but Riley can and it's okay. Nobody will look funny. Oh,
you can buy it.
What is this? No, it'll besmirch my reputation.
No. Well, don't injure your fragile masculinity by buying some seltzer.
Eggnog seltzer at that.
All right. Well, hey, thank you, Dad, for being here, talking about Bud with me.
Well, thank you, Taylor, for having me. I'll talk about Budweiser. I'll talk about pretty much anything.
Right. Okay. Thank you all for listening. If you want to find us on social media, we are Neat Boozecast on Instagram and Twitter. We are neattheboozecast@gmail.com if you want to email us. If you want to support us, we are on Patreon. Just look for Neat the Boozecast. You get all sorts of rewards, special videos, stickers, coasters, all sorts of fun stuff. And if you want to share your favorite Budweiser story with a group of like-minded individuals,
why not? We have Neat the Boozecast group on Facebook.
Yeah. Check that out. Hey, I have been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
Neat. I will say this. I don't know if you may remember this. I don't know if you were too little or not. We went to Busch Gardens in Virginia. At amusement park, which is right outside the main brewery, and the coldest and best tasting beer I ever had was at that amusement park.
In honor of Elder Bush?
Yeah, it's owned by him.
Uh-huh. Oh, I didn't know that. Wow, they have amusement
parks. I didn't know that. Yeah. So it was right adjacent to the plant, and you could get beer in there. That was before Disney World would even let you get a beer, but you could get beer at Busch Gardens.
Gotta diversify your portfolio.
That's right.
Under the Anheuser. Charlie Murray, Edison Records. Talk about the shade of the sheltering palms. Praise the bamboo tree with its wide-spreading charms. There's a little bush that grows right here in town. You'll know its name, it has won such renown. Often with my sweetheart just after the flame, to this little place then my footsteps will stray. If she hesitates when she looks at the sign, softly I whisper, now Sue, don't decline. Come, come, come and make eyes with me under the Anheuser bush. Come, come, drink some Budweiser with me under the Anheuser bush. Hear the old German band. Just let me hold your hand, yeah. Do, do, come and have a sign or two under the Anheuser bush. Come, come, come and make eyes with me under the Anheuser bush. Come, come, drink some Budweiser with me under the Anheuser bush. Hear the old German band. Just let me hold your hand, yeah. Do, do, come and have a sign or two under the Anheuser-Busch.